Welcome to this episode of the Cyber Guy Podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Supervisory Special Agent Darren Mott. In this episode, I'll discuss cyber and the military with United States Air Force Colonel Martha Monroe. We'll discuss the current cybersecurity environment within the Department of Defense and how the next generation of warfighter is being positioned to deal with the ever-evolving cyber threat that faces the United States. Before I get to the interview with Martha, let me start with a couple cybersecurity news items. October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, so let's talk a bit about the importance of cybersecurity awareness. What I'm doing this month on my LinkedIn page, or my LinkedIn profile, I guess, if you will, which you can get at linkedin.com/Darren Mott, is posting every day an article regarding cybersecurity awareness. The rationale behind that is my two passions are cybersecurity and education. Before joining the FBI, I was a high school teacher. Didn't teach computers or science or anything like that, but I do like to help educate folks. But with the cyber threat, dealing with that for 20 years and informing a lot of companies as to what the cyber threat looks like, that's very near and dear to my heart. So this being Cybersecurity Awareness Month makes it very easy for me to blend those two things. So I want to just bring forth a couple of cybersecurity awareness points for this particular podcast, and I'll probably do the same next week. But recently, a cybersecurity article showed that 65% of corporate leaders say that security awareness training is not a top priority. I repeat, not a top priority. And this is rather short-sighted in my view, as the primary vector for network intrusions is through phishing and social engineering targeting employees within a company. In other words, and I've said this before, some of you are probably sick of hearing me say this, but hackers are not brute force attacking networks and getting in that way. They are using phishing email attempts and basic social engineering to get employees to click on links, open files that install malware on computers that allow the hackers access to the networks they're trying to get into. So because of that, it should be important for corporate leaders to provide employees information about what the threats are, how they're targeting them, and how they cannot become a victim. Your number one firewall for any company needs to be your employees. If they're not aware of what to be a firewall for, it's not going to be very effective for you. So why is there the disconnect with cybersecurity awareness and leadership? Well, I think largely it has to do because awareness training and cybersecurity in general is solely a business cost. Unless you are a cybersecurity business, you're not making money on cybersecurity. You know, Marriott, Target, all these companies that had these large intrusions and loss of data. Cybersecurity and awareness training didn't make them any money, but it sure as heck would have cost them money had they had to purchase it or use it. And some, of course, there is some awareness and some cybersecurity for most companies now, but probably not to the amount that there should be. And the failure for 65% of corporate leaders in this survey not to think of cybersecurity awareness as a top priority is a short-sighted view, because the current average cost to deal with a data breach is on the rise. In 2019, a company called Poneman did a survey, and they have determined that currently, or at least in 2019, the average cost for a cyber breach event is roughly $3.92 million per event. Meaning, if you're a fairly large company and you have a data breach or a computer intrusion, it's going to cost you upwards of $3.92 million to resolve that issue. I'll give you a perfect example of this that I dealt with when I was a cybersecurity supervisor in the Cleveland FBI. I had a cyber squad, and we had a company that had called us because we had done awareness training. So they had us in to talk about what is a cyber threat, what do we need to look for, what do we need to do. So they called us one day and said, hey, one of our employees received an email, and in it was an attachment, and she opened it, the attachment. And then we realized very soon afterwards that there was malware attached to the attachment, and we took her computer offline, and now we need to know what we need to do. So the computer that had been compromised was on their network for an hour or two. It wasn't on very long. They called us fairly quickly. So we sent a team out there, and the FBI does not do mitigation. So we weren't out there to fix their problem. We were out there to try to get evidence so we could ideally find the bad guy, arrest them, and send them to jail, which is the goal of any FBI investigation. The problem for the company was they had to mitigate their network. In other words, they had to go and find if this particular malware had moved to other machines and what it would cost to fix that. So they called a third-party company to come out and do an assessment of this incident. This company came out, took a look at the malware, said, yeah, okay. So So we can tell you that this is a Chinese-based type of malware, and it has moved to at least three other computers on your system. Now, the cost that this company charged the victim company just for that assessment, they did nothing other than tell them what the problem was $150,000 in 2010. So that's 10 years ago. I guarantee you whatever they're charging for that assessment, just to say you've got bad things happening, has gone up since 2010. The amount it cost, the amount they charged this victim company to mitigate their system, meaning to go in and make sure this malware did not exist anywhere else on their network, was $1 million. So back then it was expensive. It is getting more expensive year by year. So it is important, I think, for corporate leaders to understand you can spend $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for good cybersecurity awareness training. And it's a lot cheaper to do that and even to do it on a recurring basis year in and year out than it would be to deal with one simple cyber event. And there are basically two types of companies in the United States or in the world: those that have had an intrusion or been hacked, and those that haven't been hacked yet. Or don't, I remember me rephrase that: those that have been hacked, or those that don't know they've been hacked yet. Everybody is going to be a victim because the bad guys just want data. So the other article I posted this week has to do with election-focused phishing. Because we are in election season, there is going to be, and there already has been, a rise in election-based phishing, focused phishing, meaning that you get an email that has to do with a link regarding something about the presidential election or the Senate election in your state or what have you. Or there's a link to a website to go view information on it, you know, to anti-Trump or pro-Trump, depending on who you are. They'll blast it out, and if it fits what you're looking for, you may click on that link. Well, an article in the Threat Post indicates that there is an expected rise in this type of phishing. They're already seeing it. A key quote from this article is basically says this from Eric Howes of KnowBefore, which is a training company that does phish attacks for companies. You pay them to do phishing against you to find out where your vulnerabilities are. But his quote was, "Whatever the intent behind this particular phishing attack, it should serve as a reminder that human beings, users, employees, citizens, and voters are soft targets for malicious actors." This goes back to my first article, that you need to build, if you are a company, or even if you're an individual, you need to be your own firewall to protect your data. Needless to say, once this election ends, the phishing campaigns will not end. In fact, I'm predicting that the election will not be conclusive on election night, what with mail-in voting, partisan vitriol, and so on. Thus, we will probably see a new batch of phishing attempts focused on the disconnect of the electorate. So again, if you're so inclined, if that information is valuable to you, follow me on LinkedIn. I'll be posting cybersecurity awareness training every day for the month. So there'll ultimately be 30 articles of some sort. They're not very long. What I post is very short, and it has a link to an article that focuses on that particular topic. Today was multi-factor authentication. Yesterday I did some stuff on passwords. So that's out there for you. It doesn't cost you anything to go look at it. My guest is United States Air Force Colonel Martha Monroe, a fellow Northern New York escapee and the team lead for the cyber evaluation team for the Air Force Test and Evaluation Center. Martha, thanks for coming on and welcome to the show.
Hey, Darren. I'm really happy to be here.
I know we started this conversation to get you on the podcast a couple weeks ago. I'm glad we could make it all work. I promised the Department of Defense I will not ask you for any state secrets. And besides, even though I'm retired from the government, I'm still under the same classification rules. I can't talk about anything. So this will be all completely unclassified and just general information to help folks get a different perspective on the look into cyber. The folks I've talked to up to this point have been, one was a former source for a case I worked. He works in the public sector, a couple FBI agents. And so I thought it would be, since you're in the military, be interesting to get a military perspective on how you guys look at cyber, what you're seeing, how you train folks, things like that. So hopefully we'll have some fun with this discussion. But before we get to any of that, I want to talk about our shared experience at Norwood Norfolk Central School. I should preface all this by saying Martha and I have known each other for over 40 years. We were in homeroom for 6 years straight from 7th grade to 12th grade in upstate New York. So what is your fondest memory of Norwood Norfolk Central School?
Oh, wow. Well, I have to start off by saying it was meeting you, right?
No, you don't have to say that. No one ever says that. So let's not kid ourselves.
You know, Darren, there are a lot of fond memories, which is probably a problem there because I did love high school so much. And thank you for not going back and starting to tell any stories about me in high school, so I appreciate that. I loved the people there. We really had a great class. I think we had so many talented, smart people in our class, you included. I mean, you were like the smartest person I think I've ever known. So,
well, that is now. I was number six. So there were five people clearly smarter than I was.
Okay. Yeah. But I think that really helped. You know, when you see people doing really well, like our class did, and the intelligence that we had in our class, I think that helps drive other people just to do better and be better. So I really enjoyed it. We had a lot of different types of personalities and such, but we had a really strong class. So I just enjoyed it all the way around.
Yeah, it's funny because I think if we were to go back and ask ourselves in 1984 as we're getting set to graduate, hey, I'll see you in 36 years and we'll do a podcast and we'll talk about cyber threats and I will talk to it as a retired FBI agent. You can talk to it as a colonel in the Air Force. My guess is we would look at each other and say, what the hell are you talking about?
Absolutely. I was not expecting, I was not expecting my career to go in the direction that it went and to certainly be as long as it has been, coming up on 32 years now. So I was definitely planning on being retired on a beach by now, but that's okay. I enjoy what I do.
Well, you seem to post a lot of pictures on Instagram like you're at a beach. So it looks like your backyard is like the beach. So let's talk about your military career path. So what led you to your current position? So obviously, you know, in 1984, we graduate high school. I go to SUNY Potsdam right up the road, never expected to leave St. Lawrence County, but thank goodness I did. But how did you get from, you know, a senior in upstate New York to an 18-year-old in upstate New York to where you are now? So just kind of talk us through what that looked like.
Sure, absolutely. So I started off in college as a programmer, or I came out of college as a programmer, and went into the Air Force. And I loved programming, but back then that was just the start of outsourcing, when they were starting to outsource those types of jobs. I had the opportunity and the blessing to get to program in the Air Force, which a lot of people did not get to do that. So that was a really a great first job that I had. It got me to be able to see what good programming was and how to do that. And I get to work a really exciting system called the Defense Support System, which was our early warning missile defense system. And that whole job just taught me a lot. And then from there, I went and I ended up kind of becoming a program manager over software development, again, as we continue to outsource software development more and more to the government contractors, we still needed people to oversee them. So I got to also learn a lot from that sector and how they did certain things. And I know I'm really dating myself here, but about that time, they were coming in with desktops, and that was a new thing. So because of my background, I also became a LAN administrator in the office at that point in time, and that taught me how to deal with people a lot, I have to say, because I was the office help desk. I think that was the first, you know, true kind of computer help desk, and people would get really frustrated when they couldn't log on to their new system, and I got called around the office a lot to help people, so...
Were things networked internally then, or were they networked globally through the internet at that time? How did that kind of look during those years?
The Air Force was starting in its own LAN, so we had it we had our own LAN system, and that was how that worked. So and then from there, my next main communications officer job was down at Fort Belvoir Defense Logistics Agency, working with J6 Enterprise Information Systems. And that was kind of a turn for the whole community at that point in time as well, because I think that was when enterprise, you know, that idea was just coming into play of how do we get enterprise licenses to save money? How do we get enterprise contracts to save money and consolidate all those contracts, maybe those support contracts for help desk and such? Again, I feel like, you know, every place I went, every job that I did, especially in the Air Force, and that's the great thing about the Air Force, I think, is that you can have a career, you can come in and say that you're cyber, but when you do that, you're not stuck doing the same thing over and over again. When we say cyber, there's so many different facets to it. You can do so many different things, and again, I've been blessed to be able to do that. So that was great. And then most recently, I worked for the Chief Data Officer of the Air Force, trying to consolidate data, and the Chief Information Officer. So those jobs as well are very interesting. They get a lot of great initiatives going on for that. And then now my most current job, I got the pleasure of working with, can I say names here? Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Dr. Kamal Jabor, who's the senior scientist for information assurance for the Air Force. And he had started this team called the Cyber Blue Book Team, where we were doing cyber vulnerability assessments of Air Force weapon systems, helping out the Air Force Test and Evaluation Center. And so I took that over, and I've been doing that for about the last 5 years. And we've evolved that into something called MRAP-C, which is the Mission-Based Risk Assessment Process for Cyber, and which will become the main process for the Air Force to do cyber evaluations, vulnerability assessments on its weapon systems and business systems. So, again, just such a diverse job. You think offensive, defensive, when you think cyber perhaps, but there's so many different types of initiatives going on and programming and different oversight even that you can do. So those opportunities are just boundless.
So I got to think you have seen the cyber threat, obviously, and the amount of cyber risk within networks change in 32 years. When did you first start seeing not just the criminal activity, because criminal activity has always been around technology. So, but as far as like nation state activity, when did that start becoming really a big deal? You don't have to talk specifics, obviously, but if you look at the evolution of the cyber issue or issues regarding cyber, I guess, if you will, when did you first see that starting to become a large problem where you had to deal with educational awareness for employees and a little more concern as far as, you know, what are people are installing on networks and things like that? How did that look to you as you followed your cyber career followed from starting 32 years ago to where we are now?
Yeah, I think that whenever we create something that's really great that we could really do a lot of great things with, there's a lot of smart people out there that want to see how many bad things they can do with that too. And that's really too bad, because if they would just take that that intelligence that they have and that drive and put it towards good, it's amazing how far we probably could have gone right now. But unfortunately, you know, it's almost like from the very beginning, you see something. And when we talk about, you know, what is a cyber threat, we really have three main classes of cyber attack, right? There's the destructive attack, and that's pretty easy to detect. And then you have access-less attack, which is traffic manipulation. And then you have the advanced persistent threat, which is very hard to detect. I think over time you had your basic hackers who would maybe try to see if they could get into a system, not necessarily knowing what they were going to do once they got in, but it was exciting. And once they got in, they did see what they could do. And today, it's come a lot farther than that. We're not talking about, you know, individuals who are just hackers anymore. We're really talking about nation state hacking, and that's very developed. They're trained in doctrine. They're trained in the art of cyber warfare. They have adequate resources. They're very talented. They have the money that backs them. They're certainly briefed in our missions and our systems. They're able to find that information relatively easy out on the, unfortunately, the internet today has a lot of information, so they can go find that. They understand protocol specifications. They try to get embedded in our supply chain. And they're persistent, right? So they situate themselves where they have access and they can maintain, you know, years of persistence. It's really, I think, you know, as the internet has evolved, as we have evolved with our technology and what we can do, both offense and defense have to constantly stay aware and on top of what we're doing and each other, because the attacks are just continue to come. I think, I don't know what it was 10 years ago, but I believe there's a million new viruses being created every single day.
Yep.
And so it used to be, you know, the best offense was a good defense in warfare, right? But that doesn't necessarily equate when you're talking cyber. Defense is hard and defense is costly. And that's what we're really having to deal with today.
Yeah, and I think defense requires the personnel to help play defense. And so, you know, reports I've seen is that by the end of next year in the private sector, there's going to be 2 million vacant cybersecurity jobs. What's that look like in the DoD in the sense of, are you recruiting folks to handle the cyber aspect of what you need from both a defensive and offensive situation? And the reason I ask that is that, so if someone's listening to this podcast and they have a kid who's in high school or a kid who's in college trying to figure out what to do with themselves, I would assume that if, at least it's always been my opinion, that the best cyber training I've seen is coming from folks who were in the military doing it beforehand. Do you agree with that, or what's it look like from your perspective there?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And it's we definitely need more people in cyber, for sure. And we need to increase our capability to educate and train people in cyber. I think the colleges need to do a better job at that. I think we, the United States, have in the past done a great job, but we've started to fall behind a little bit, and that's really too bad. We definitely need to be putting out much more, from a numbers perspective, people that are in math and science, have math and science degrees. And I'll say people, but, you know, especially females too. We definitely fall short and I'll say that because I'm a female, falling short from the number of females that are getting into math and science. But the Air Force Academy just started offering a cyber science degree. They had a computer science degree beforehand, but they just started offering a cyber science degree in 2017. That's focused on offensive and defensive cyber ops, combat communication, which is another great field I forgot to bring up, but fantastic career field in the Air Force. They learn how to operate, maintain, and defend networks. They do secure command and control, which is, of course, is extremely important to us, and even acquiring new systems. So when you think about the cyber career field, it's not just the cyber personnel that need to understand it. really the people that are acquiring our new systems need to understand it as well, because cyber is so integral to the systems nowadays. But for that class, for the computer, for 2019, the computer science class, only 17.6% were females. Mm-hmm. And we really need to encourage women to do more and be involved more. But as a whole, we need to get more people involved and more focused on cyber from a nation perspective. And I just want to talk about something called the AMC International Collegiate Programming Contest. And that takes place every year. The results are usually, we've done well, the United States has done well in the past, but ever since about 2000, well, ever since around 2005 or 6, we've started to fall short. We had always had universities in the top 10 historically, but around 2005, 2006, I don't know what happened with regard to how or what we were teaching. Maybe we were falling behind and teaching old methods or things like that, but we started falling behind. Certainly Russia has picked up, done better than us. China, Poland are all doing better than us in this. And most recently in 2019, we only had one college that ranked in the top 12 even for this contest, and that was MIT. They did place number 2, but still, in the past, we had done much better. So I think as a nation as a whole, we really need to start focusing more on how we get people out there with good cyber degrees.
Oh, that's a great point. And I think that, you know, some of the companies I've spoken to or have had relationships with, they're really not even interested anymore in people with 4-year degrees or even master's degrees. They're looking for those with maybe 2-year degree, but a lot of certifications, because that's kind of where, if you're, you know, the more degrees you have, you're just learning more or being more educated. You are just learning for the sake of learning. But if you have tons of certifications, then that makes you more marketable to a lot of these companies, because they just want people who can, you know, do network security and those kinds of things. Are you guys seeing that as well?
That's a great point, Darren. I think that the certifications are extremely important, because you learn, you get a good baseline in college, right? And you get good background, you get history, and maybe even it brings out a little bit of strategic thinking in you. But when you come out and going back to my earlier comment about why my first job out of college in the Air Force was programming, I was so blessed to do that. It's really because you don't get to do that tactical level work that especially the certifications get you. You know, to be able to be hands-on and experiencing that and doing the job that you had your college degree for, a lot of people don't necessarily do that. So I think it's so important to get the certifications and actually execute the knowledge that you were trained with, so that you can use it real world. And that just enhances your understanding and your talent and your ability to be able to, not only in the future, you know, as things move along and progress and change, you're able to change with it, because now you're seeing and experiencing stuff. You have the background to have had knowledge of that, and then you are able to go ahead and change and make those necessary changes based on what it is that you're seeing.
And I'd say save your money for your bachelor's degree, your master's degree, and let the company you go work for with your certifications pay for those degrees.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
So obviously, you know, the cyber has changed over the years, and the big talk now you hear a lot about is cyber warfare. And what does that look like? How do you, you know, you ask 10 people what cyber warfare is, they'll give you 10 different definitions. I think it's almost impossible to define that. But Russia has been one of the main drivers in using their cyber components to impact or enhance their more kinetic warfare type of actions. In 2007, they didn't use a military action here, but they hacked Estonia when the Estonians moved a Soviet statue. In 2008, when they invaded South Ossetia and Georgia, they launched cyber attacks against the government there. And in 2014, when they were fighting with Ukraine, they did the same thing. So in your opinion, what do you think the next global conflict, or do you think it'll have a cyber component, and what do you think that would look like?
Oh, boy. I believe, well, you know, when you think traditional global conflict, I think what people don't actually understand is that we're in a global conflict right now, right? I mean, the cyber war is happening. It occurs now, and occurs at every level. I mean, it occurs at the nation state level. It occurs at the organizational level, and it occurs down at the individual level. And you have to make sure that every day you don't have somebody come and steal your identity or get into your bank account. And companies certainly have to ensure that they keep all their proprietary information secure. And like I said, as far as a nation, the Air Force networks, the various government networks are attacked, and people try to hack in every single day. So we're in a conflict right now. The problem is, it's hard to actually say that. You know, cyber, we can easily say if someone crossed our borders and came in, you know, to our country, that's easy to say that we're being attacked, because you've got a physical barrier, the land, right? But with cyber, there's no physical barriers. There's no geographic borders to cross, right? It's boundless. So cyberspace domain becomes really difficult to say, you know, we're at war or not. And the problem with that is that when you're executing cyber operations, it's all anonymous, right? You can't really tell who's doing what. So if China's attacking us, we don't necessarily know it's them unless they fess up and say they are. They could say it's Russia or somebody else. So in order for us to lay blame or hold anybody accountable, that becomes extremely difficult to do. It's very difficult to prove who did anything. There is huge legal issues in it, being able to find out who necessarily is doing something. So that's just that is something we are going to have to learn to tackle, certainly. And it's going to become more and more of an issue, I think, in the future.
That's a great point. I mean, it's funny because it's not. If China launches a missile, we can pretty much attribute that missile from China because we saw where it came from. But if they launch an attack against Boeing or attack against Raytheon, exactly like you said, they're going to say, hey, that wasn't us. You guys attack us more than we attack you, so I don't know what you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be continuous, ongoing back and forth. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and the other, you know, the other thing with the cyber domain is they can hit us in so many different perspectives, and we really need to think about that. You know, the next global conflict, if they really did bring in a cyber component, there's so many different ways that they can do it. It's not just one single way. You know, we always worry about the financial systems. That's usually what people first key in on, is what if they somehow take down our financial systems? Well, what if they take down our military, for sure. That's always a risk. All the corporations, what if they wreak havoc on our basic corporations? Corporations are always looking for support and help from the nation to protect them, and it becomes very hard to do that. And even again, down to the individual level, they can threaten, you know, human rights and privacy, and it's very hard to protect against those things. And especially because you're not fighting a warfare that's just coming from one front, right? I mean, there's millions and millions of hackers out there, so the attacks are coming from everywhere. So it's just, it's something that's really, really difficult. And when we do have that next true, in the traditional sense, global conflict, there are so many different aspects in today's world, I think, with regard to cyber and the way that it can be used. We really need to think through what is the biggest risk. To, of course, it's always back to the goal and what it is that we need to achieve within that conflict. But what is the biggest cyber risk that we may have? And not only that, but from our perspective, from the U.S. perspective, how can we use cyber to enhance what it is that we need to do?
Oh, yeah, that's all a great point. I just read a book called Total Power. It's by a guy named Kyle Mills. He writes for... So there was an author named Vince Flynn who used to write a series of counterterrorism-related fictional books with a main character who's a CIA assassin, so on and so forth. But he passed away several years ago. But this particular author, Kyle Mills, picked up the mantle and is running with that character. But this particular novel has to do with a hack against the power grid. And it's very well researched. And if anything that's in it came even close to remotely true, we would be completely screwed. The funny thing in it is the bad guy in it goes to the Russians first and says, hey, I have all this information. You can take down the power grid. And the Russians were like, you know, screw that. That's going to hose us over. So they end up going to ISIS, and I don't give it all away. But I think that is probably one of the key vulnerabilities we have as a country, that everything relies on power. You take it offline, what's going to work?
Yes. Right. And you mentioned the Ukraine, and you know that issue with the Soviets taking down their power grid, and I think when you have the ability to do something like that, that's the other thing about cyber. You may have the ability to do something like that, but you don't want to necessarily play your hand of what you can do, because then both your allies and your enemies know that you can do it. And sometimes for cyber, what we have for cyber weapons becomes a one-and-done type of thing.
Right.
So now they know you can do it. So how do you already defend against that?
Right. Yeah. If you can have a drawer full of zero days, but once you launch them, they're going to figure out how to defend against them. So you have to be careful on when those get launched. So look into your crystal ball and predict what the future of cyber operations look like, and how is the DOD going to adjust to that battlefield? You only have to give the best part. Mm-hmm. Just, I guess, let me rephrase the question. So if you look into your crystal ball, you've seen the cyber threat and risks from cyber evolve over time. What do you think the next big cyber innovation is going to be? I see this commercial on TV for this new TV show called Next or something like that, where AI is taking over the world and wants to kill everybody, kind of like Terminator. So where do you see the cyber threat progressing to as we progress through the next 10 years?
Oh, yeah, I think AI plays a big role in that. Absolutely. We were talking about defense earlier, and, you know, again, with the viruses that are coming out today, and we were talking about the hackers and how smart they now are. You know, it's really, we used to worry about, well, if they get in, if we have, you know, poor passwords, so let's make our passwords longer or things like that. But But now they are so smart, and the viruses are being created today. You know, usually for defense, it's just detection, and you can look for a certain signature and find that. But they're able to make things that change their signature. So how do you find viruses when they become more and more complex like that? It's just the attacks are so much more complex and calculated. So really, the cyber operations that we'll have to adjust to is, I feel, is the enemy will drive more and more to the attacks. You know, you just brought up zero day. It's going to be their time and place of choice, right? And they could be sitting in systems for years and years and just waiting for that right time of when they choose to implement that attack. And we won't know that they're already sitting there. So that becomes very difficult. So cyber operations and being able to take the human out of the loop almost and put in more AI and being able to implement that in such a way that we are able to better detect, we are better able to certainly attack, and how we integrate that into our operational plans, our battle plans, and what we want to achieve, the countermeasures for the effects of cyber ops on us, and being able to do that fast, that's extremely important. And sometimes with the human in the loop, you have to think and consider, well, is this really an attack or is it just a glitch? I can't really tell. So hopefully we'll be able to move AI along that we won't have to do that. It'll already be in place and know what exactly is going on. Beyond that, though, I think, you know, for the military, especially for us, and building cyber operations and a good cyber understanding into the doctrine of what we do and how we can use it to uniquely impact the battle space is also extremely important. So how do we enhance and support our airspace, sea, and land operations? I think we need to think about that more and more every day. You know, we think I think sometimes, you know, it's important to think about cyber and cyber attacks separately because it certainly has its place and it can certainly perhaps set up, like some people think that if we do a warfare, cyber may have its most important role in the first 5 minutes. And then after that, we've lost the surprise, and it probably won't have as much impact after that. But really, how do we support and enhance those other domains? And I think back in the early 90s, when we really, during the Gulf War, and we first started really using space, it was space's big opportunity to come in and enhance the war. A lot of commanders didn't necessarily know how space could come in and support and help them. And I think that's the same way that situation that we're at today with cyber. There's so many cool things that cyber can do, and we just need to ensure that our leadership, our commanders all know that.
Well, that is great stuff, Martha. I really appreciate it. My last question, I'm going to loop back around to question one. And if you could go back to your 18-year-old self, what would you say to yourself?
To buy Apple stock.
Yeah. Or no, cryptocurrency. When was it? 2010, when cryptocurrency comes around, buy Bitcoin. Buy as much of it as you can.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So do you ever make, when's the last time you went back to Norwood?
Oh boy. I was just there a few months ago. I had a really great time. But I guess I would have to say you know, what you asked me what one of my, what I liked most about high school or one of my greatest, fondest memories. And I have to say that, kind of one of the things that, that led me onto the path of going down to, you know, a cyber career field. I don't know if you recall this or not, but you were in this as well. We were in a talented juniors program, I think in the 11th grade. And, we got to go to St. Lawrence University and do a basic programming class. Do you remember that?
I don't.
Okay, I thought you were.
I don't believe I was there. I think I remember you guys doing it, but I don't believe I was part of that. Actually, I know I wasn't. I know I wasn't because you can go online and find our yearbooks from on at St. Lawrence. There's like a St. Lawrence Heritage site, and so I was going through and looking at that at the yearbook today, and I saw that page that said the St. Lawrence whatever junior. I was not in that. I was not. But you and a bunch of other folks I knew were obviously, but I was not part of that.
Yeah, there was just a small handful of us, maybe about five or six, and I don't know who thought or considered me for that and thought that that would be a good thing for me to do, but I had a guardian angel somewhere there at school that put my name in for that, and I would say that was a game changer in my life to be able to have gone and done that and have been exposed to programming and what programming was all about. Because when I went off to college and, you know, you get the advice from your guidance counselors, et cetera, and they were saying, well, go be an engineer. And so I spent my first year trying to be an engineer and quickly realized that there's no way in heck that I could ever be a good engineer. The school did have a computer science program. And thinking back to, I really enjoyed the class that we had taken out at St. Lawrence University. And so I said, yeah, what the heck, I'll move over and try that degree. And I loved it and it did fantastic. So I guess if I had to say anything to my 18-year-old self, it would be follow what you love or you like, not what others expect you to do or suggest that you do. So while I liked programming, no one ever suggested it to me, and I really didn't therefore think much about it. So maybe, you know, and also find a mentor, a good mentor that will help you and guide you in life. That's so important. And if you have any young listeners, that's definitely something I would encourage people to do. Find a mentor. And this isn't a peer. This is somebody that is definitely a little further than you in life and at a place that you would like to be someday. That's probably the best mentors to look for in my mind.
Yeah, it's funny because our friend Thad will listen to this podcast and he will be pumping his fist because clearly the guidance counselors at Norwood Norfolk did not probably steer us in the right direction because they didn't do much. And that was always Thad's argument was, I don't know why we had guidance counselors. They guided us to do nothing because we all ended up going doing different things that were outside of whatever we got from our guidance counselors. But
we absolutely did, but that's okay. You know, I feel like no matter what, you know, and if you don't even go down that perfect straight road of where you're supposed to end up, I think the curves, you know, they're all by choice, but they're all for a reason, and you got to learn and grow along the way. But eventually, you know, we all get to where we're supposed to be. So
absolutely. So when's the next reunion?
I think we're starting to do them every year. So maybe you'll show up at one.
Yeah, maybe I will. Maybe I won't. Actually, if you have in Huntsville, then I'll go to that one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We could. That would be really fun in Huntsville.
Yes. All right. Well, Martha, I very much appreciate you coming on. This was a great conversation. That's good stuff. I'm going to use this podcast as my day 7 of cybersecurity awareness thing on my LinkedIn profile tomorrow. So I appreciate you giving me content that I don't have to think about tomorrow. So thumbs up on that.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. You be well. I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank Colonel Monroe for participating in the Cyber Guy podcast this week. I do have to apologize. Last week, there was no Cyber Guy episode. I had laryngitis, so I decided to give my voice a rest. That's why there was no episode. So you didn't miss a week. There just wasn't anything last week. So coming up this coming week, hopefully I may do one a little earlier. I'm still looking for a good guest to have on, but needless to say, I will have some information to provide you regardless of what that may be. If you have any questions you'd like me to address on future podcasts or topics you'd like to hear, feel free to email me at Darren, D-A-R-R-E-N, at thecyberguy.com. Cyber is spelled C-Y-B-U-R, guy.com. You can find this podcast at all the usual spots, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and so on. And if you're so inclined, please leave a review and tell your friends. Also, if you're interested in soccer, I produce another podcast called College Soccer Nation with Division I soccer coaches Chris Pretricelli and Matt Mott. They discuss the goings-on in college soccer world and have guests from all over college soccer. Feel free to check that out, College Soccer Nation. And remember, as you progress through your week, make sure you understand the threats that are facing you, assess your risk, and proceed wisely. Thank you. Have a good week.